The Healthy Alabama podcast is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a program that enrolls Alabamians in the health insurance marketplace.
Enroll Alabama is a project of AIDS Alabama. For more information, visit the website AIDSAlabama.org. Welcome to the Healthy Alabama podcast, sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a project of AIDS Alabama. I'm David Person. This episode is very special to me. First, because I'm proud to be joined by my friend and colleague of many years, Carmela Monk Crawford. She is the editor of Message Magazine, the oldest religious publication targeting African Americans in the nation. Secondly, I'm proud and excited because Carmela and I interviewed Brian Stevenson, the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. And of course, if you know anything about the Equal Justice Initiative, you know about the great work that Brian and his team have been doing down there for many years now. Brian has also founded the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which some people also call the Lynching Memorial, and the Legacy Museum, which is a fantastic multimedia exploration of the journey of African Americans in this nation from slavery through Jim Crow and lynching and segregation, all of that to today. In this wide-ranging conversation, which we conducted at his office in downtown Montgomery, we discuss Brian's work with death row inmates, the memorial and museum, and the connection between his work and the public health of Alabamians and the nation. But first, we start with his childhood and early influences.
I grew up in a poor rural community at a time when black kids were excluded from a lot of things. I started my education in a colored school. When I was a little boy, we went to this little tiny shack. We used to drive past the public school, and I'd ask my mom what the word public meant, and she'd bite her lip, and she was somebody who would always answer every question I asked her, but she didn't want me to know that that school was intended for me, should have been available to me, but wasn't. And, you know, when you grow up marginalized in that way, you don't have the same opportunities, and the church became the institution that allowed us to grow, to have space, to be who we are. It was in the church that you could say something and be seen, and people would embrace you and affirm your humanity. So as a social institution, as a cultural institution, the faith, the church played a critical role in the lives of people like me growing up. And then obviously, as I got older, it became more than a social and a cultural institution. It became a place for real development, the beginnings of faith and belief and what it means to be fully alive. And that shaped my life. That shaped my work. I grew up, my family was very musical. And so when I was really small, they just put me on the piano. They said, start playing. And, you know, in my church, you couldn't play during the main service until you'd spent time playing for devotionals, the testimonies before the services. That's where I kind of learned to play. And I think about that now a lot because it shapes the work that I do. Because, you know, when you're playing for the devotionals, these people would come in, these mothers and grandmothers and families, and sometimes their testimonies were heartbreaking. Didn't have enough food to feed their family, didn't know where somebody was who was supposed to come home, challenges around economics, challenges around relationships. But they would finish their testimonies and they'd always start singing a song like, wouldn't take nothing for my journey now. And I think that acculturated me to believe that faith and the kind of work that we're trying to do means situating yourself in difficult places and having the hope, the conviction, the belief that the difficulty that you see does not define your capacity to overcome. And it just shaped my worldview that justice is a constant struggle. If we want justice in our community, we're going to have to struggle. And you get rooted in that. You get comfortable with that. And that has shaped my work. I mean, for me, the Gospels are about hope. And I believe the one thing that I have to be is hopeful. I actually believe that hopelessness is the enemy of justice. Injustice really prevails where hopelessness persists. And the great challenge we face in our criminal justice system, in so many of the areas where we do work, is that people have become hopeless about what they can do. So I wanted to create an institution that is rooted in the hope that we can make a difference, that we can save lives, that we can disrupt some of these conditions that have been so dreadful and devastating in communities of color. And I still feel that hope, and that's the blessing that has shaped my work, is that I feel really centered in what I do. I don't ever begrudge having to come to work. I'm ready to come. And it's been joyful, despite the challenges, despite the enormity, to feel purposeful in what you do. And that's the best, you know, the best job you can give anybody or offer to anybody.
I'm thinking about a couple of the anecdotes in your book in which hymns or songs from your childhood play a prominent role.
Yeah.
One that was really striking to me was, well, there were two, but one that really got to me was The Old Rugged Cross.
Yes.
What do you say to someone who is facing death?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. It was surreal to be in that situation. And this was a case where we opened this project in 1989. And I didn't have staff yet. I didn't have books. I didn't have the things I needed to actually represent people. And this young man called me and said, "Mr. Stevens, I'm scheduled to be executed in 30 days. He said, "Will you please represent me?" And it broke my heart, but I said, "Well, I'm sorry, we're not ready to take cases. I just opened the doors and we just got this line working." And I explained to him I just wasn't ready, and he didn't say a word. And then he hung up. And it was so unsettling to me that he just hung up that I didn't sleep much that night, came back the next day. And the man called me again. He said, "Mr. Stevenson, I know what you said about not having your books and your lawyers and your computers." He said, "But I'm begging you, please take my case." He said, "I don't think I can make it the next 29 days if there's no hope at all." And when he said it like that, I couldn't say no, so I said yes. And we tried really hard to get a stay of execution for this man, and every court said too late. And that's the challenge of this work. Our legal system is more committed to finality than fairness. And so every court said too late. And on the day of the execution, the Supreme Court denied our last stay motion, and I went down to be with this man. It was the first time I'd actually not been able to achieve a stay. And the surreal thing about that was the conversation that I had with that man when I got there. We were praying. It was very emotional. And he started telling me about his day. He said, "When I woke up this morning, the guards came to me and said, 'What do you want for breakfast?' At midday, they came to me and said, 'What do you want for lunch?' In the evening, they came to me and said, 'What do you want for dinner?' And he said, every 30 minutes, somebody was saying, 'What can I do to help you?' And he said, they kept asking me, 'Do you want the phone to call your family? Do you want stamps to mail your letters? Can we get you coffee? Can we get you water?' And I'll never forget that man saying to me, he said, 'Brian, it's been so strange.' He said, 'More people have said, what can I do to help you, in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life.' And holding that man's hands, I couldn't help but think, yeah, where were they when you were 3 and your mom died? Where were they when you were 6? And you were being abused? Where were they when you were 9 and you were being sexually assaulted? Where were they when you were 13 and you were experimenting with drugs? Where were they when you came back from Vietnam traumatized by that injury? I know where they were when you were accused of this crime. They were lined up to execute you." And with those questions resonating in my mind, they pulled this man away. They shaved the hair off his body. This is when they used the electric chair. And they placed him in the electric chair, and he had two requests. He was a military veteran, and he wanted his American flag sent to his family. And he said, "If you can't do anything, please do that. I want people to know I served my country." And then his other request is, "I want them to play The Old Rugged Cross when I walk to the chair." And I wasn't sure the prison would allow it to happen, but they did. And there was something surreal about this man who had been, who had the hair shaved off of his body, who had been prepared for execution, to be led to this place where he was going to be burned to death, and to see people trying to reconcile what they were doing to him while listening to this song. And I don't think there was a person in that room that felt like what was happening was a good thing, was the right thing. I thought Everybody there knew this was wrong. And that was the thing that was strange for me. I didn't expect that. But that's the way the truth can function and manifest itself. And the truth of what we know about salvation and conviction and resurrection, all of that was in that room. And it implicated what we were doing, what they were doing to that man. And it made a real impression on me. When I left there, I thought, you know, I've got to find ways to block people from being in a situation where they're going to be executed. But more than, I've got to find ways to block people from doing something fundamentally unjust, fundamentally, in my judgment, against what I believe to be God's commandments. You know, we had a judge that just, I don't know how the timing works, but we had this election. We were talking about putting the Ten Commandments in public places. We have a judge put the Ten Commandments in court. When that debate was going on and people felt so strongly we ought to be able to put the Ten Commandments in our public spaces, we did a billboard campaign, and we put up billboards across the state. And our billboard said, "Keeping the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill." And we asked people to reconcile that commandment with this fascination, this commitment we have to executing people. And so, yes, the songs have always, you know, I grew up in the church with music, and it has shaped my experiences, my worldview. And that was certainly one of those times where it did something to the space to hear that hymn in a place like that.
I'm listening to you talk, and it's hard for me to remain objective.
Yeah.
What you're saying, because so many people go to church.
Yeah.
And that experience goes right over their head.
Oh, yeah.
And so many people, they don't absorb it in such a way. You know, you might as well have gone all the way through theological school to absorb that.
Yeah.
Is there a part of you that wrestles with God? Because I hear you say, I've got to come back and find a way to address
this. Yeah. You know, for me, I just feel privileged to have purpose, to have meaning, to be centered in what I do. You know what I mean? I think, and that's the other hymn. So when I was, you know, I go to college, I end up in law school, and I'm just following this path, but I don't really understand why I'm on the path. I think for me, because I'm a product of Brown versus Board of Education, because lawyers came into our community and made them open up the public schools, and that's what allowed me to go to college and law school. I felt like, well, that's the kind of power that maybe I should try to access to help other people. Because I never really did believe in the political process, in the sense that there was never a time you could get the majority of people in my county to vote to end racial segregation. The schools would still be segregated if it took that. We needed the rule of law. And that's what got me to law school. But when I got to law school, I was alienated. I was lost. The people were they weren't talking about racial bias. They weren't talking about social inequality. They weren't talking about poverty. And I felt a little distraught. And I left. I went over to the School of Government to get a degree in public policy, and I didn't find what I was looking for there. And I was really struggling. I was beginning to rationalize accepting a career as a lawyer that I knew would not animate my life, would not engage my heart. And I was trying to persuade myself that it would just be a job like everybody else's job. And I began to doubt that the privilege of education is that we get to make choices about what we do. And then I took that internship that sent me to Georgia, where I met condemned people. And in my book, I write about going to death row, so nervous and so anxious and so worried about what was going to happen, and concerned that this man would be really disappointed when he discovered I was just a law student. And they took me back there, and this man walked out, and he was just burdened with chains. He had handcuffs on his wrist. He had a chain around his waist. He had shackles on his ankles. And they unchained him, and that man walked over to me, and I just started saying, look, I'm so sorry. I'm just a law student. I don't know much about the death penalty. I don't know much about procedure. But I told him they had sent me down there to tell him that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next year. And when I said that, he said, wait, say that again. I said, you're not at risk of execution any time in the next year. He said, wait, say that again. I said, you're not at risk of execution any time in the next year. And that's when that man grabbed my hands and he said, thank you, thank you, thank you. He said, you are the first person I've met who's not a death row prisoner or a death row guard in the 2 years I've been on death row. And then he said, I've been talking to my wife and kids on the phone, but I haven't let them visit because I was afraid I was going to have an execution date. He said, now because of you, I'm going to see my wife. I'm going to see my kids. And I couldn't believe how even in my ignorance, being proximate, being in that place could make a difference. And we started talking. It turned out we were exactly the same age. And 1 hour turned into 2 hours, 2 hours turned into 3 hours. We were still talking. I'd only scheduled to be there an hour. And the guards got angry that I was still in there. And they came bursting in there, and they got mad, and they took it out on this man. They couldn't do anything to me, so they threw him against the wall. They pulled his arms back. They put those handcuffs back on his wrists so tightly I could see the metal pinching his skin. They wrapped the chain around his waist. They put the shackles on his arm. And I was begging them to be gentler, and they ignored me. And this condemned man looked at me and said, Brian, don't worry about this. You just come back. And they started shoving him toward the door. And they got him near the door, and that's when he planted his feet. And he didn't move the next time when they shoved him. And he turned to me and he looked at me and said, Brian, don't worry about this. You just come back. And then that man closed his eyes and he threw his head back and he started singing. And he started singing, I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. And then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And everybody stopped. And the guards recovered, and they started pushing him down the hallway, and you could hear the chains clanging, but you could hear this man singing about higher ground. And I knew then that I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground. But I also knew that my journey to higher ground was tied to his journey. And from that moment, I've had this sense that I'm where I'm supposed to be. I've had this purpose, and that's a gift from God. You know, that's a true gift, because it radicalized my interest in the law. I went back to Harvard Law School. You couldn't get me out of the law school library. I needed to know everything because now I had this mission, this purpose. I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground. And when you are mission aligned, when you actually get to do the thing that fulfills you and makes you feel like you're serving the way you're supposed to serve, you wrestle, but you don't wrestle with God. You wrestle with the challenges and the obstacles and the complexities of what it means to be as effective as you possibly can. And to me, that was a gift because it just opened up all of these insights. You know, I used to read, you know, the Apostle Paul and all the wonderful letters that have shaped the way the church functions. But, you know, after that moment, I didn't just read all of those books, those testaments, those letters. I thought about Saul. Because, you know, Saul was a criminal. He was someone who committed all kinds of felonies. He was condemned. He was imprisoned. And I thought about what would have happened if we had executed Saul. We wouldn't have had the Apostle Paul, all those powerful. And I just began to realize that there is purpose in standing next to the souls of this world. And maybe their redemption can yield something powerful, transformative. And it just wasn't something I'd thought about before. So for me, it's been a joy. I feel really privileged, you know, to do what I do. I feel like it was a gift from God to meet a condemned man who sang to me and to have that song not just get in my ears, but get in my heart. And, you know, it's challenging. There's no question about it. There's all kinds of challenges. But I have never doubted the value, the purpose, the mission, the capacity to see real redemption in places that other people give up on. And there's nothing more inspiring and energizing than to go into what people call dark places and find these amazing lights, you know, these lights of hope and redemption.
Years ago, I was interviewing former Governor Bob Riley.
Yeah.
Sitting across from him as close as we are.
Yeah.
And the interview was about the death penalty.
Mm.
As you recall, he was a fervent, ardent supporter of the death penalty. And I asked him specifically about how, as a Christian, he justified his support of the death penalty. And he gave me an answer. Mm-hmm. That was probably an answer you and I could imagine readily. But I'm curious to know, Brian, when you encounter people of faith, people whose faith is as fervent as yours is, mm-hmm. but who see this issue so differently. Mm-hmm. What do you say? How do you engage?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, it's really not about the morality of the death penalty, the propriety of the death penalty. I think, at least in this country, the threshold question of capital punishment is not, do people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed? I think the threshold question is, do we deserve to kill? And we have a criminal justice system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. We have a criminal justice system that is corrupted by a history of racial inequality where black and brown people are presumed dangerous and guilty. We make a lot of mistakes in this death penalty system. For every 10 people we've sentenced to death, we've now identified one innocent person on death row who's been released after being proved innocent. It's a credible rate of error. I mean, 1 out of 10. And if you went to the supermarket and 1 out of 10 apples, if you bit into it, killed you, you would stop buying apples. They wouldn't even sell apples, right? But we tolerate this error in this space. And so I actually don't think we have to persuade people that the death penalty is theologically or morally unacceptable in all contexts. I'm prepared to have that conversation. But even before you get there, if it's applied against the poor unfairly, if it's applied against people of color unfairly, if we don't do it reliably, the question is, why do we think we have the right to kill when we make those kinds of mistakes? And so for me, wherever you are on the moral question, you ought to be on the fairness question, on the justice question, aligned with those who think we shouldn't be executing people. I mean, that to me, it's about justice, right? We're taught, prophet says, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. I don't think we're walking humbly if we are arrogant enough to believe that despite all of these problems that are readily in front of us, we still get to kill. I don't think it's consistent with loving justice if we're tolerating the kinds of mistakes that we see. You know, I represent a man named Anthony Ray Hinton, spent 30 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. 30 years. And we did that. We're the ones who took away that man's. And so that's where I think the issue has to be evaluated. And the truth is that we spend a lot of money trying to execute a few and then don't have the money to protect the many. So we don't provide public safety like we ought to poor people and people of color. We don't even solve some of these crimes that we ought to be solving because we don't have the resources to invest in that. We like the optics of something like the death penalty. And so from a public safety perspective, I don't think it's how we should be spending our money. And then I just feel like, you know, it's not about, you know, it's not about deterrence. It's not about anything. It's about revenge. It's about retribution. And I just believe that vengeance belongs to God, and we are arrogant to assume that we can speak for God in the space of our criminal justice system on these issues. And that's where I think people of faith need to be focused, need to be thinking about this. You know, you meet some of these people who have been wrongly convicted and condemned, whose lives were almost taken because of the unreliability of our system, and you have to ask, why do we support that? And I think that's really the question. You know, we have so many tools to punish people, to keep people from hurting other people, that don't require the death penalty. And that's the other question. That's the Catholic Church's position as well. If we don't have to do it, then why would we do it? And I think people of faith have just not really struggled with this, haven't talked about this, they haven't thought about this. When we put up those billboards about thou shalt not kill, you remember we had a lottery debate around the time when Governor Raleigh was in office. He wanted to bring in a lottery to fund education, or there was some discussion about that. And the church said, no, we're not going to have a lottery. And I supported that. I didn't think we should have a lottery either. But their campaign strategy around the lottery was to put up billboards that say, the lottery, what would Jesus do? And it was intended to motivate people to see the lottery is not something consistent with what people of faith should want. So again, right after that, we put up billboards that said, the death penalty, what would Jesus do? And we had the scripture, let him as without sin cast the first stone. We had so many people call us angry, people of faith. What are you doing talking about the death? I said, well, we're quoting scriptures on the billboard. Why is that a problem? And it was in part because people hadn't talked about it, hadn't thought about it. They didn't like being challenged in that way. But that's what we're called to do. And you spend time where I am. I just believe the Gospels teach me that we are all more than the worst thing we've ever done. All of us. I think if somebody tells a lie, you're not just a liar. If you take something that doesn't belong to you, you're not just a thief. I think even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. The scriptures tell me that there is more to you than your worst act. And if that's true, then we ought to be talking about how we get to redemption. How do we get to recovery? And that's the part that I struggle with when people try to preach to me that there's some value, some need for executing people. I just, you know, these are folks they're not a threat to public safety. And I just think when you get into this space and you begin to see the realities of how the death penalty is applied, it doesn't become a complicated issue for me as a person of faith.
So because of the redness of the state, mm-hmm. politically speaking, mm-hmm. and the election that we just had mm-hmm. last night, mm-hmm. It's become even more, the redness, the conservative political and social nature of our state has become much more entrenched. Mm-hmm. We now have, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court,
yeah.
An acolyte of mm-hmm. Moore, mm-hmm. Tom Parker, mm-hmm. who I think will take positions mm-hmm. that are antithetical to what you just talked about, mm-hmm. and that Supreme Court rule. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the mythical Sisyphus who's pushing the ball off the hill and then you have it rolled down again?
There are times, I read about Sisyphus when I was a freshman in college, and I just kept thinking, man, he's a fool. I don't know why anybody would do that. And as I've evolved, I've come to identify and appreciate that struggle more and more. And, Sisyphus believes that he just has to keep pushing harder, that somehow, some way, there is a way to get this boulder over the top. And I think despite the political moment that we're in, it is important to have that belief. I just think we have to continue to believe things we haven't seen. For me, faith is about believing things you haven't seen, is having this vision that other people say is a crazy vision and just being motivated to achieve that vision. And so I have this vision that we will stop killing one another one day, that we can do better than presume people dangerous and guilty because of their color, that we can do better for the poor, that we don't have to throw everybody away. We've declared this misguided war on drugs. We said, oh, people who are drug addicted and drug dependent, those people are criminals. No, we didn't have to say that. We could have said that drug addiction and dependency is a health problem. And we need our healthcare system to help them recover. They need our help. But we said the opposite. So we put hundreds of thousands of people in jails and prisons. But I absolutely believe we can get to something better where we stop doing that. And so it's a struggle. It's a journey. And you're absolutely right that the political culture that we're in right now is going to make that journey harder, more complicated. But, like those older women who used to testify in my church, you give your testimony, you assess the difficulty, you're not in any way confused about the hardship and the complexity, but you still say, wouldn't take nothing from my journey now. You still understand that even with this court, that we can find a way to create some justice for people. And that's the way I kind of look at this. 8 years ago, 10 years ago, people say, oh, it's a post-racial America. Everything has changed. We want everything. And we were saying then that's not true. That's not honest. That's fuzzy thinking. And 8 years, oh, we lost everything. And that's fuzzy thinking, too. You know, it's a struggle. And you just have to keep struggling. There's never going to be a time when I believe people who believe in justice, people who believe in helping the poor and helping the marginalized and helping the condemned, we're ever going to get to sit down and say, we won, struggle over, battle over, we're where we're supposed to be. It's the nature. It's the call. It's like faith. You don't ever get to the point where you've mastered everything. So, oh, I don't have to believe anything anymore. I've just got there. It's the journey. And, yeah, it is worrisome. You know, I'm not going to lie. But I'm encouraged, too. I mean, I've seen people. We had some really amazing things happen during the election. Florida, 1.4 million people had their voting rights restored because they passed an amendment that will now restore voting rights to people who have been formerly convicted. That's a huge success. That was a very close gubernatorial race. You know, not all of those 1.4 will vote, but you think about half of them voting. And you can imagine some different outcomes. Colorado, we worked with some people. Most people don't know that the 13th Amendment doesn't totally abolish slavery. It says slavery is prohibited, involuntary servitude is prohibited, except for people convicted of crimes. And so we have actually an exception to our restriction on enslavement. And we've been asking the question, well, why in America don't we just totally abolish slavery? And just people have been unwilling to talk about it. Well, you know, these people in Colorado put it on the ballot. And a majority of people said, you know, we should actually eliminate that exception to enslavement. We should be a country that never tolerates enslavement in any circumstance. And Louisiana has an anachronistic Jim Crow law that doesn't require a unanimous verdict in certain kinds of cases. And that's been used to create some of the most severe racial disparities in who gets convicted in the nation. And yesterday, the state finally eliminated that exception. And now all verdicts will have to be unanimous. And these things are positive and hopeful. They're part of what struggle has yielded that I'm encouraged by. And there's always going to be, you know, something that is pushing you forward and something trying to hold you back. That's the nature of that struggle. But I'm encouraged, even though I'm very aware that we're going to have some difficult challenges with our new state court.
Dr. David Williams at Harvard and some others have done research and concluded that racism is a public health issue.
Mm-hmm.
You've created this phenomenal museum across the street and a memorial down the street.
Yeah.
Do you think that racism is a public health issue, and do you believe that the memorial and the museum a part of the antidote?
Yeah, I do think it is. I mean, I just think we're not free. I think we have been burdened by this history of racial inequality, and it's created a kind of smog that's in the air, and we've been breathing it in for generations, and it has made us sick. Mm. We've embraced this narrative of racial difference. If we walk into a room, the first thing someone's going to see is two black men and a black woman. They're just going to see three black people, and then they're going to parse down gender, then they're going to parse down, and where are you from? But that color, that race, is going to be the first thing, and that narrative of racial difference, which shapes the world for so many people, has created distortions, and I just think that it has made us ill. We haven't talked about the problem that we have. And so I do think that the treatment, the prescription for this illness, has got to be a narrative struggle. We got to talk about the fact that we live in a post-genocide society, that what happened to Native people when Europeans came to this continent was genocide. And we didn't deal with it as a genocide. We said, no, those Native people are savages. We used this rhetoric that was rooted in race to justify that violence. And that's why, for me, the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. It wasn't forced labor. It was this ideology that we created that black people aren't like white people. It was this myth, this narrative of racial difference. They actually said black people aren't fully human. Black people can't do this. Black people can't do that. They got the court to say black people are three-fifths human. And that narrative created this ideology of white supremacy. And I really think that was the true evil of American slavery. And we didn't deal with it in the 13th Amendment, which only ends or prohibits involuntary servitude and forced labor. And that's why I've argued that the 13th Amendment didn't end slavery. And slavery didn't end in 1865. It just evolved. It turned into this period where then black people were pulled out of their homes and they were hanged and beaten and drowned and murdered. And we haven't talked about it. And I think our silence has allowed that illness to proliferate, to actually spread. And, you know, we're living in a region where the violence and the terror was so traumatizing. And black people, older black people, come up to me sometimes. They say, Mr. Stevenson, I get angry when I hear somebody on TV talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time after 9/11. It's a provocation to them. And they're right. And the demographic geography of this nation was shaped by racial terrorism. The black people in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles and Oakland, Boston and Minneapolis didn't go there as immigrants. They went there as exiles and refugees from terror in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Georgia. And it left an injury, a trauma, a pain. And then we had all of this codification and all of this legalization of racial hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Whites only, colored and white, that iconography, which is what our families and our parents grew up in. And, you know, we haven't dealt with that. And those signs that said white and colored, they weren't directions. They were assaults. They created real injuries. My parents were humiliated every day by that iconography. And that narrative of racial difference persists. And today, we still live in a country where this infection, this disorder, this disease continues to manifest itself. And it doesn't matter whether you're a person of faith, doesn't matter whether you're a bishop, or a minister, or an elder. It doesn't matter if you're a kind person, doesn't matter if you're a great student, doesn't matter if you're an architect, doesn't matter if you're a lawyer or a doctor. If you're black or brown, you go places in this country and you're going to have to navigate this presumption of dangerousness and guilt. We unconsciously are doing things all the time to manage the presumption that we have to overcome. And that's exhausting. It's unhealthy. And that's why I agree that it is a public health phenomenon. So we've got to now change this narrative. And I look at what they've done in South Africa. You can't go anywhere in South Africa without being confronted with narratives that remind you about apartheid. Their constitutional court is surrounded by the images and iconography and monuments and memorials designed to make sure no one forgets what black South Africans went through. In Rwanda, they're changing the narrative. They have a genocide museum. You can't spend 2 days in Rwanda without somebody talking to you about the genocide. In Germany, you go to Berlin, you can't go 100 meters without seeing markers and stones that have been placed next to the homes of Jewish families that were abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans want you to go to the Holocaust Memorial. They want you to reflect on that history. They're trying to change the narrative. They don't want to be thought of as Nazis and fascists forever. There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany. There are no swastikas. But in this country, we haven't talked about slavery. We haven't talked about lynching. We haven't talked about segregation. We have Confederate symbols everywhere. This state Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. We don't have Martin Luther King Day in Alabama. We have Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. 59 markers and memorials in this city. The two largest high schools are Robert E. Lee High and Jefferson Davis High. And when I moved here, you couldn't find the word slave or slavery or enslavement anywhere in this community. Majority black city. And so that has to change. And yes, that's why we built this museum. That's why we built this memorial. And some people think it's scary and it's put... I don't. I think people sometimes think, you know, I want to talk about this history because I want to punish America. I have no interest in punishment. I want to liberate us. I think there's something better waiting for it. And as a person of faith, I've just learned that to get to redemption, there's got to be confession. There's no church in America you can go into and say, I'm perfect, I'm clean, I'm good, I'm all of these things, but I want all the stuff that y'all are offering. They say, no, you've got to repent. There's got to be confession. And it's not a bad thing to confess. There's something that comes after that, that is cleansing, that is energizing. That's how redemption happens. And we haven't done that as a society. So yes, we want to talk honestly, directly about the pain and the shame and the hardship. The heartache and the brutality of enslavement. We want people to see these monuments and understand the trauma and the terror and the taunting and the menacing that people of color had to go through. And then we want them to tell the truth. And I really do believe that after truth comes redemption, comes reconciliation. You know, we quote this, truth shall make you... I believe it. I do. Mm-hmm. And we haven't been truthful about our history. So I do think there is a process that we can go through that can begin to heal this disease. And I also think there's something better waiting for us. I really do. I think there's something better waiting. All of us, not just black people, white people, there is something that feels more like community, like fellowship, like love waiting for us that we cannot fake. We can have all the ecumenical events we want to, but until we talk honestly about this disease and get to a true cure, true healing, we're not going to get where we're supposed to be. And I think God wants us to get there. I do. And that's the vision behind these sites.
I'm thinking about you in this neighborhood,
yeah,
where you're standing strong with this marker right,
yeah,
now in the office and the museum, right down the street,
yeah,
from the Confederate,
yeah,
lighthouse,
mm-hmm,
making your own stand.
Yeah.
What I want to know is, where can we all stand behind? You're right there,
sure,
about to push it over, if you, as it were. If you say, everybody, let's push here.
Yeah.
There's a vulnerability.
Yeah.
I can see something happening.
Yeah.
Where can we follow?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I think we can actually just lift up the truth. I think because even within our communities, we haven't wanted to talk about the hardships. We haven't wanted to talk about the pain. We felt like our survival required us to just be silent in our coping with this. And that's what, you know, that's what our foreparents who have made the biggest difference have taught us, is that sometimes you have to stand up even when people say sit down. Sometimes you have to speak even when people say be quiet. And we just have to find the courage to tell our truths. And so we have a calendar. I want everybody to get our calendar. It's a calendar that talks about the history of racial inequality. It's not a feel-good calendar. It's a truth-telling calendar. You know, and I just want people to get it, put it up in places where people need to see that truth. I want people to come to our sites and spend time. You know, we sing these spirituals. We hear people singing these spirituals. Now we hear them singing them in these big cathedrals and these very, you know, ornate concert halls, and it's wonderful. But we want them to come to our site, and we want them to see these slave pens that we've created, and we want them to hear the stories of enslaved people talking about the heartbreak of being separated from their children. And then we want them to hear these women singing, Lord, how come me here? I wish I'd never been born. This may be the last time. Walk with me. It's only when you can actually be in a space like that that you can understand the power of these songs to give people the faith and the determination to persevere. So we want people to come to our sites. We want them to join the efforts that we're making. If you come to our website, EJI.org, we're constantly putting out things. We're asking people to stand and support. I hope they'll do that. And then we have a big project. If you live in one of the 900 counties in America where lynching took place, we're asking you to begin talking to your friends and your neighbors and your church about organizing a community remembrance event. And we want to come to your community, and we want to go to the lynching sites, and we want to dig soil, and we want to put it in a jar. We want to put up markers at every lynching site in America so that the landscape begins to cry out. You know that scripture where even the rocks will cry? I believe that. And we can get even these inanimate objects, these signs, to speak to the truth of this history. And then with our memorial, which has all of these monuments, we have a replica for every county in America where lynching took place. And we're asking people to organize and claim their monument. And we want that monument to go back to their community. And so if you live in any of these communities, there's an opportunity for you to say, I'm going to bring the monument to my space, to my community. I'm going to put up a marker in my space, and we'll work with you on that. And it's been beautiful to see that happen in communities. We've been in Oxford, Mississippi, and Gadsden, Alabama, and St. Augustine, Florida, LaGrange, Georgia, Nashville, and Memphis, Tennessee. All of these communities have begun to take on this project. People of faith have come together, and it's been beautiful. It's been powerful. And so, yes, we are pushing, but we're not pushing alone. This is the thing that I'll have to tell you just empowers me. You know, you live in Montgomery, you know, this street is Commerce Street. It's where thousands of enslaved people were trafficked during the slave trade. We're just a few feet away from where people were lynched. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat just down the street. Dr. King preached just down the street. And when you live in a place like this, there are days where you are challenged, and there's a lot of people pushing against you, don't think you should be doing what you're doing. There's a lot of resistance, a lot of pushback. But there is also the blessing of being in a place where you can hear the souls and the spirits of the enslaved, those who were lynched, those who have struggled, those who have fought. And what they are saying is, you keep fighting. And, you know, that scripture that talks about being surrounded by that crowd of witnesses, I feel it. Mm. And that's the blessing. That's where God's grace allows you to do the things that you have to do. Because there's never been a moment when I've had to doubt that there are a lot of people saying, you keep fighting. And we're going to all get something that God has promised to us. And that's the joy of it. That's the joy of it.
It was a pleasure to join my friend Carmela Monk Crawford of Message Magazine in this conversation with Brian Stevenson. Thanks to Anthony Perkins and Chris McNish for capturing the audio. I'm David Person, host and producer of the Healthy Alabama podcast, which is sponsored by Enroll Alabama, a project of AIDS Alabama. For more information, visit the AIDS Alabama website, AIDSAlabama.org. Our theme music was produced by my man DJ Bailey, and this podcast is produced in partnership with Oakwood University Radio, Praise 90.1 FM WJOU. Until next time. Be healthy.